My name is Nyer Ernest, chaplain of Pioneer Square, sometimes known as the chaplain of Pioneer Square Ecumenical Parish. And we're going to be talking about story, about Ivor's story, and then some other healing stories. I maybe would like to begin by just reminding you that it is Grundtvig's Day. And for those of you that are Lutheran, if you're not so Lutheran, you can get off the hook on this one, that Martin Luther said, and I think we should rethink this one, that next to the scripture, the Christian should read the stories of the saints. And we're talking about healing stories. And I think that in these delightful stories of the saints, some of them get pretty far-fetched, but that's okay. There's a reason that they tell some of these far-fetched stories, and maybe we can learn more about reality from the fantasizing than we can about history at times. So I would encourage you, to, if you can find ways, to get acquainted with the lives of the saints. And I was just looking at September. This is an exciting month. If you really wanted to kind of do this, just taking the Lutheran calendar, and then there are others. Today is Grundtvig. And I don't know hardly anything about him, but for a quarter I found a neat book on him culling out of the library. And not only found a neat book on Grundtvig, but I found a neat one on Nathan Soderblom, the great Swede, and I don't know him very well, and I want to get better acquainted with him. And then there's another one on Niebuhr. So for 75 cents, I've got some fun stuff coming up. But the other people, one of the things about Grundtvig, like so many of the great people, he stirred up things and was not always appreciated in his day. One of the great, and in fact, the big Grundtvig church in Copenhagen is made, looks like a mammoth organ. I mean, they love this guy. And of course, he did enough, so they finally had to make him bishop. But they wouldn't trust him with the people, so they never gave him a diocese. So he was a bishop without any people. But at least he died a bishop. I think that's kind of neat for some of us that goof up and God uses anyhow. Something to reflect on. And then on the 4th is Albert Schweitzer. Delightful stories. At a garage sale in Ballard, I run into a little book of his sermons. I'd read his stuff and about him. And he's controversial, kind of, among Lutherans, because he was kind of far out in some things, but what a guy. And what sermons. Oh, his confirmation sermon at St. Nicholas Church. Greatest confirmation sermon I've ever read. Schweitzer. They used to ask him, you know, why he always rode third class on the trains in Europe. You know why he rode third class? Why would someone of his stature, you know, a genius as far as theology and medicine and music and one of the most respected people in the world of his time, but he always rode third class. Why? Well, that isn't what he said, but that's pretty good. He smiling says there isn't any fourth class. And then comes John Chrysostom, going way back, the Golden Mouth. And I run into him early too, because I was looking at both of these books. Page one on the introduction to Niebuhr's book and to Soderblom's, both had a quote from St. Chrysostom going back, what, to about the year 300 or something? And the quote was, Do I have the wrong book? Yep, I don't have that. Oh, here, I'm going to find it, I think. Well, this is pretty close. If you praise someone, you should follow them. If you're unwilling to follow them, you shouldn't praise them. Now, I think Chrysostom was talking about Jesus. And I think that's a good one to think about in terms of that. If we do all this going to church and singing hymns and praising and all that, Chrysostom, the golden mouth, said, then we should follow. Some of these great saints that Luther talks about and we tell the stories, if we praise them, we put them in their calendar, I think we should learn some things from them, some of those beautiful things from their stories. Then also we come to Holy Cross Day. Well, that's another thing to remember. We could find out what it's all about. Then Dag Hammarskjöld. Wow. Spend a little time in his markings, huh? And St. Matthew, he's a good guy. And then Sergius of Radoziches or something, abbot of Holy Trinity in Moscow. Maybe to some of the Russian stories. St. Michael and all angels, and then Jerome. Boy, what a rich month if we were just wanted to delve into the stories. But today, we're going to hear about Ivar. And I'm going to call him Ivar, even I'm not really the proper, because when I first heard the story, and the man that told it I respect so much and so indebted to, that's what he said. He didn't know better, I guess. This is told by Robert Bella Wilhelm, great storyteller that I think takes a couple groups of people to Ireland every summer for 2-3 weeks to reflect on some of those great old Norwegian, Swedish, Irish, Celtic stories. And I think this is a story, among many others, that has changed my life. Being with him has changed my life in that when I read biblical stories, I try not to read them as a Lutheran. Say, what does this mean? All this stuff. When I do my exegetical work, then I take out my commentaries and I break up my Greek and I do all that and I exegete. But when I read devotionally, I try to enter into the story and kind of sense as I sit back what it smells like there. So if the story is by the lake and there are fishermen, I smell fish. Huh? And if it's in the morning, you feel the morning. And if it's under a tree, I sense, in terms of this olive tree or this entering into the story, so you feel what's happening and then you hear the story. And once in a while, because I think stories are so delightful, I will rethink and kind of tell the story from the vantage point of that olive tree. Doesn't that, you know, there's a lot of people that heard that story, that were a part of it, and, you know, John tells a story one way and somebody else tells it another. And then I use my imagination and I let the olive tree tell the story of what was going on. I will never forget when Gerhard Frost, the great professor at our seminary, stood in the old Muskego Church. That's the oldest Norwegian church in America, and it's very different. And he told the story, and he let that old building tell it, creaking, and oh, it was awesome. Never forget it. Now, some people worry about us, people that tend to be a little mystic and you know, use our imagination too much. So I go back to Joan of Arc, Bernard Shaw's book, you know, they asked her all these visions. Is it just your imagination? She smiled and said, how else does God talk to me? Think about that one. Okay, now I guess I'll have to ask you to imagine you're in Norway. What, 400 or 500 years ago? And we're going to listen to Ivar's tale. And I'll just see if there's something in this story that kind of hits home. There once was a man from Iceland who was a great poet and singer who won fame in the court of the King of Norway, the court of King Eystein. The king thought much of young Ivar and bestowed many favors upon him and upon his brother Thorfinn, who also lived in the court of the king. Now, Thorfinn was dissatisfied because of the many favors bestowed upon his brother, and he felt that he had been slighted and that his own gifts had gone unnoticed. And so Thorfinn decided to return to his native country of Iceland. Before he left, however, his brother Ivar asked him to bear a message to a young woman called Odni. Ivar told Thorfinn to tell her not to marry anyone until he returned in the spring. And so Thorfinn left and had a good journey and arrived in Iceland, where he met Odni. But he himself asked Odni for her hand in marriage. And so when spring came, Ivar returned to his native land only to discover that his brother had married the woman he loved. And he was filled with sadness and bitterness and returned to the court of King Eystein, a broken and a bitter man. When he returned to the court of the king, all noticed the change, especially the king. The joy in his singing had gone. His enthusiasm, the enthusiasm of his stories, had waned, and Ivar was a sad person. One day after the main meal had been finished, the king called Ivar to his seat. Ivar approached the king, and the king, in a low voice, so that no one else would hear, asked the young Icelander what was the matter. Ivar said, "I am sorry, my lord, but I am not free to disclose what is troubling me." King Eystein then said, "Well, that is no matter, because I will guess, for I know that something bothers you, and I will get to the root of this. Tell me, is there someone here in this court whose presence offends you in some way?" And Ivar said, "No." "Well, then, do you think that you are not given sufficient honor?" And once again, Ivar said, "No." The king thought for a moment and then added, "Well then, Ivar, is there something in this land that you desire?" And once again, Ivar said, "No." The king pressed him, asking if there were country estates that he wished for, and Ivar sadly said, "No." Then, sensing that the issue was that of a woman, the king asked, "Is there a woman, perhaps a woman in your own country, whom you long for?" And Ivar remained silent, and the king knew that he had asked the crucial question, and Ivar nodded yes. The king smiled and said, "Ivar, there is no difficulty with that. I am the mightiest king in this part of the world, and no one would dare to interfere with my wishes. The next boat that leaves for Iceland will have you on board, and you will take a letter from me to her family saying that it is my wish that she become your bride. And certainly, no one in Iceland or anywhere else would dare to interfere with the wishes of King Eystein." Ivar said, "It is impossible, my lord. Not even that." The king stopped and looked at him and said, "Do you mean she is married already?" Ivar nodded, and the king once again fell into silence. Then after a few moments, the king said, "Well then, Ivar, we must think of something else. The next time I make my rounds of the countryside and visit the villages and the towns and the castles, I will take you with me. And as we travel, you will meet many beautiful women, and perhaps your heart will find one of them that will satisfy your deepest needs." Ivar shook his head and said, "No, my lord, for every time I see a beautiful woman, I'm reminded of Odny, and my grief is deepened." "Well then, Ivar, I will give you lands and estates, large estates, so that you might devote your energies to taking care of the farming and other business matters that will keep you so preoccupied throughout the year. With your hands filled with the work that has to be done, you will soon forget the woman, and happiness will return to you." And Ivar said, "No, my lord, I have no wish, no desire, no ability to do any work." The king, who cared deeply for Ivar, thought some more and then said, "Ivar, I know. I will give you money, large sum of money, so that you can travel wherever your heart seeks to travel, to the farthest corners of Europe. And in your travels, you will see many things and experience many adventures. And when all of this is accomplished, by then you will have forgotten the woman in Iceland." But Ivar once again refused, saying he had no desire, no wish, no ability to travel anywhere. The king now thought and thought and thought, and was unable to come up with any suggestion that could help Ivar in his predicament, until he finally said, "Ivar, there is only one possibility, one last thing I can think of. I know that the suggestion is a weak one compared to the others that I have made, yet perhaps in some way it might be of some help to you. And so I will make it anyway. Ivar, after the dinner meal is over every night, once the matters of state are taken care of, and after the tables have been cleared, I invite you to stay here with me and spend as much time as you need and to tell me your feelings of your love for this woman, Odny. You may do that as long as you need, and I will be here." And Ivar agreed. And every night, when the meal was over, the tables were cleared, the business matters of state were taken care of, Ivar came to the throne of King Eystein, and there he told him his story. He told him his story for days and weeks and many weeks, and every time when he had finished the story, the king Never let him leave without giving him some sign, some token of care that he had for Ivar. And so, the end of each story, he gave him a small but meaningful gift. As the weeks turned into months, Ivar found that he had told his story. And when his story was finished, his old joy returned to him. And once again, Ivar began to sing, and Ivar began to tell the ancient stories of the Scandinavians, the ones they loved so dearly. And so he became not only a famous poet and storyteller in the court of the king, but Ivar became a happy man. In the following year, he met a young woman from Norway with whom he fell in love and who loved him. And so Ivar remained a famous and happy man, spending all of his days in the court of the king. Just an old story. When I came to the Compass Center, Jim Fergan wanted me to come down and to help them. Because this story has changed my life. Because I had done all the stuff with committees and all that stuff for years and years, I says, you know, yeah, I'm retired, I'd love to. But one condition. I never have to go to any meetings I don't want to go to. And boy, I don't want to go to many meetings. And there was a time they were terribly important. And I can sit and I can listen. And the miracles happen. And because of this story, I never say to somebody, you've told me that before. Some people have told me 20 times. One of the tasks we get as Christians out of the life of Jesus in the story of the gospel is to love people, right? I don't think that I am capable of loving in depth another person until I've listened. I really don't. And I guess I wonder if very many of us are capable of truly loving another person until we've listened. Your reaction. Or your story. Talk a little bit louder.
I came here cold, and I don't think I felt it on the way here, but after I've been here for a couple of days, I don't remember what touched it on. Probably conversations with other women. The loss issue was a real strong one for me. Loss through death. And was able to process some of that through the Vespers that we did the other night.
Mm-hmm.
And in conversations with people, was able to tell just a piece of my story.
Yeah.
And it's funny how different pieces become significant at different times. this particular piece wasn't really very important until a few months ago. And for some reason, it became very, very important. And I hadn't even focused on it. I hadn't known that it affected me the way it did until it sort of faced me when I was dealing with it. And I find that it sort of reshapes the whole story from these pieces. The particular piece was the shooting of the students on the Kent State campus and how that affected me.
I didn't hear all of your thing, but we find that for me to tell somebody about my loss, but it's more helpful to me to share too. And I understand because I don't mind hearing other people's stories. In fact, there's a lot of things you think, oh gee, you know. And a lot worse than I did. You reach out for them though, and you care.
Our Native American friends have, lots of them have lots of hurts. They come in. And sometimes we need to find different ways to help people to tell their story. And so often if person sitting there and I can feel that it's difficult. I get up and I walk over to our little altar and I take a little piece of sweet grass off the altar and I say, is it okay if we burn some sweet grass? And I light the sweet grass and smudge a little bit. And so often they'll start praying. The thing I notice about Native Americans, they don't want the padre to pray for them. They want the padre to be there and for them to offer up the prayer. And then the stories start coming. And I think the point where so often healing really is needed is the place where the tears start coming. And I've seen so often with Native Americans, by the time they're through, you know, down below, it's wet. The early church fathers and mothers of the desert believed that one of God's greatest gifts was the gift of tears. I can feel now, you know, where I need healing. So the tears come. Old Indian George for years. All the hurts because he cared and kind of a father figure, and for what, 2.5 or 3 years, every Wednesday night, almost without exception, he's there for the Eucharist at our little chapel. And he lights the sweet grass and smudges us all and leads us in terms of the confession of our hurts, and the hurts of the world, and open to the goodness and graciousness of God. And we all look at the crucifix for a little bit. And three weeks ago, George was found out in the streets, dead. It's not easy to let it come out. But somehow, in the midst of our sharing story, I think this is the first time the tears have come on this. And it'll take time for the healing. A story of George. Maybe that'll help me. Soon after I came down to the Compass Center, after I'd been away from the streets for a while, I had one of those bad days. Just too much stuff. And I was sitting there in my little office alongside the chap. Kind of my head in my hands. And I don't know, I think I was trying to pray. But really not. And I hear a knock at the door. I didn't want to see anybody. No, why did they go away? And it's George. And he said, I was working up on Beacon Hill. That's about 5 miles away. And I felt that my pastor was hurting. So I had to leave. Can I come in and pray for you? George believes that God has given him the gift of healing. And I think a lot of people will just laugh at him, you know. Because all he does is burn sweet grass and pray and chant. Doesn't have all these psychological insights and all that stuff. I'm not quite sure even how we're going to adjust in terms of Wednesday night with George not there to do the smudging. Praying for someone that George's mantle can fall upon, because
maybe you could do something for a while in his honor, do some of the smudging that he did or something.
Yeah.
And it might be helpful for you also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry. No, I'm not sorry. Thank you, I mean. Oh, it's so good to let some tears come. I've wondered why they wouldn't come.
I'm a nurse in Everett, the hospital there. And part of the joy of my job as a nurse is hearing all the people's stories.
Yeah, good.
They tell me.
Yeah.
And I work on a unit where they stay a little bit longer than they do on other units in the hospital, so they might stay a week or two. And after hearing their stories, it's hard to say goodbye to those people. And they just, I see them 12 hours, it's night shift, but you hear stories at night.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And boy, you really, like I say, once you've heard their story, and everybody's story is so special.
Yeah.
And you're a courageous person to be here in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And it's neat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I've met a lot of neat, neat people.
Yeah.
And neat stories.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there are very many stories that are told that don't incorporate some healing into them. You know, we may not even know that we're hurting, but just there's something about sharing a story. I don't know, but I wonder about that.
I figured I was going to say, I thought you were finished in the middle there, but I took a class on storytelling,
mm-hmm.
and I never really looked at it the way this guy was explaining a story, how simple a story can be, and just how important stories were in our lives, that we tell stories all the time. A day in our life is a story. You know, 15 minutes in our life is a story. And to hear the stories, I think it goes back to what you were saying on knowing somebody. To hear that you can't really know a person, you can't really communicate with a person, I think, until you know get into their shoes, or know their story, where they're coming from, why they do the things that they do, and stories are a way to do that, to let people know about you and to know about somebody else. So you have a relationship.
I know, I belong to a grief support group, you know, where I said, well, why do you go there? I don't, you know, when I made that kind of stuff, and I said, well, you don't know what you're missing, you know. I just think it's very important to go and to share things. And then there's a special bond that develops between you that would have never happened otherwise.
Right. Mm-hmm. You want to share a little bit more so we can understand what kind of what you're...
What happened?
Yeah.
My husband died last year.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I found out it's also important. You have to find the right grief support. I went to a few for... And sometimes I would be the only one there. That wasn't what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I found one that someone had said about at a Baptist church there in town, a large one, and people come from all over town and from mm-hmm. They're all ages.
Yeah.
And it makes me want to reach out, and I find that because I think when you're there, it's always hard to be the new one in, and they invite you to share your story. If you're not ready to do it, you know, then you can come for a while, or you don't ever have to if you don't want to. But most people do. Maybe sometimes they're not ready the first time. Mm-hmm. But I find that when somebody's new in the group now, that I try and get their numbers and try and call them during the week and just check and let them know that somebody's there for them. Mm-hmm. And we usually go out to eat together, and so we... Like I said, we don't all, you know, it's more than you go through your time of sorrow, but then you can still go out and have a good time together too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes the time when we think that we're kind of well from a situation, but we're still in recovery.
Yeah.
And we need to keep, you know, other ways, but I mean we still have some very... Especially true for the alcoholic, drug addict. Yeah.
Well, as you well know, about 25 years ago, I was going through a very painful divorce experience. And when I think back at how many times some of my good friends listened to my story,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought, how in the world did they stand this?
Mm-hmm.
Listening over and over and over
mm-hmm.
to my story, just like in the story about Ivar. but it really brought back to me how important that experience was mm-hmm. for me to be able to tell this over and over mm-hmm. and over. And you think that once it's told, that would be enough, but it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of this coin is that during that particular year when all these horrible things were happening, and I was teaching, and I was teaching at the college level, so these were mostly adults.
All adults.
They didn't know what I was going through, and I had to be ready to teach at 7:30 every morning and so on. And maybe after having had a horrible, terrifying experience during the night or whatever. And despite this, my students didn't know what I was going through. And yet during that year, for some reason, so many students came to talk to me in my office about painful experiences that they were going through. And I thought, what is this all of a sudden that these people are coming and sharing these things with me? So it was, you know, it was two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when one of my students found out toward the end of the year what I'd been going through, she said, I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And yet there was something about this that was assuring, that was kind of like a small miracle. Mm-hmm.
Well, not so small.
Bigger?
Not so small.
Well,
I mean, but you, if a bigger miracle makes you stand in more awe than a small miracle, I have a feeling it was a pretty good-sized one, wasn't it?
Well, and the thing is that these friends who listen to me over and over and over are still the people that I feel the closest to. Mm-hmm. Even though one of them tells me the same thing over and over and over, mm-hmm. and then I say, oh yes, I know you've told me that before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have a little guilt on me this morning.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons, you know. I don't say that. I never say that or turn them off sometimes, but it's a reminder that they're not through telling their story until they're through telling the story.
But you know, I find, again, when you do tell it, it's healing, but I also find, I don't go over and over with my friends what we tend to do a lot, and that's why, to me, a grief support is important or something, or you meet strangers sometimes, you start talking to them, mm-hmm. and to me, that's kind of better, because then you don't feel, because I find that it's really hard for people who have not been through a loss like that to understand. And so a lot of times it's better to someone that has been through a loss that you can talk to them and they will mm-hmm. understand more than your best friends have, because I never understood before.
Right. Yeah.
And if you haven't been there, mm-hmm. you know, other people think you need to get on with your life and mm-hmm. put that behind you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen overnight.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you, Kay. I have, you know, quite a number of friends that are in the 12-step programs. And for many of them, at least my friends, the top of page 20 of the big book is one of the most important. I mean, it's one that surfaces over and over again. Top of page 20, I forget the exact words, but the thought is, in our life of recovery, and I guess I would say in our life, our very lives depend on our caring about others and finding ways to help them. And of course, an awful lot of that is listening to the story or that sort of thing. And so when you talk about, you know, them coming and your students coming to you because they sense something, you were giving them a gift and they were giving you a gift in the midst of that, I bet, huh? It was a part of the healing of the good stuff, because in the midst of your hurt, you were able to give the gift of listening to them. Yeah. Not easy, because you had so much to carry on yourself. But,
Maybe that's why I could listen.
Yeah, right, that's right. Yeah.
Well, two things I'd like to say. There's a great deal of difference, I think, between a divorce, a very painful divorce, and a death.
Oh my!
Because in a divorce, you try to figure out why,
mm-hmm.
what happened.
Yep.
And also because it's the massive rejection
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When a spouse dies, you're not rejected.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
okay.
Sure.
So that makes a great deal of difference.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, when I say one particular friend who tells me the same thing over and over and over, it's a little different. It isn't a healing situation for her. It's that maybe she forgets that she told me before,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
it'll be about, you know,
yeah.
something that happened.
Yeah, yeah.
It isn't expressing a hurt or anything. So maybe I don't feel quite as guilty.
Just be who you are. Give the gift of yourself. Do it the best you know how. But you just made me think in terms of the different varieties. And sometimes because we go through something, we think somebody else is going through the same thing. That's why it's so important we have to listen, because maybe though we've been through it, their experience is entirely different. And I had a group of young people from Augsburg College in Minneapolis that were in Seattle, and they wanted to walk the streets and get the feel of that. And, you know, that was fine. Good with Midwestern kids down there. I thought it'd be a good influence. But there's one of our saintly, beautiful alcoholics, former Navy pilot, Marcus, just an absolutely lovely person, but with about as severe a case of alcoholism as you can have. And Marcus wanted to walk with us, and I says, fine. And we walked through Occidental Park, which is a couple blocks from the Compass Center, where lots of people congregate. And as we were walking across, this one lady came and she was just dancing across. Marcus could hardly stand it. She was so happy. He goes, "What are you so happy about?" She turned around. "My husband just left me today." That's the other side.
I had a friend that just went through that. Her husband just left her.
Yeah.
And she had been married for like 25 years and just been miserable. I mean, he had done
yeah.
everything that anybody could possibly do to wreck their marriage.
Uh-huh.
And she stayed in it for the sake of their two boys.
Yep.
But now the two boys were raised and they were gone. And she called me up and she said, "Guess what? Gary left."
And that's a story that needs to be listened to, too, isn't it?
Yes.
So often we get the idea that we've got to that we could share our joys, but I mean our sorrows. But it's harder to find someone that can do a good job of listening in terms of our joy story.
Well, I have a friend also who doesn't ride. Her husband had wanted this place way, way out in the country, and they were up there, and he died.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't know how to get out, and she stayed there for 2 days with that body. But she's going on, you know, "Well, now I can do all the stuff I didn't want to do. I didn't want to be up there in the first place, and he didn't want me to do this, and he didn't want me to do that." So and sometimes it's like that too, you know, and I just, that's the thing, I just kind of listen, but it's just kind of hard to imagine, you know, but everybody has their own feelings about things.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And also sometimes the sorrow becomes the joy. My father's passing in 1963 was, it turned out, the liberation that my mother needed. He was 26 years older than she. She called him Daddy. Never called him by his first name. And at the age of 3, she was 41 when he died. It was hell with 6 kids ranging in ages from 16 to a year and a half. Five little boys. But she went through her adolescence, basically, when I went through mine.
Yeah, yeah.
And learned how to become a person. And was, you know, was enormously depressed for, I don't know, it seems like years. You know, and because he was the focal point and foundation of her life. She
sure.
just she was a mouse, you know, in the presence of this person.
Mm-hmm.
He was her daddy, he was everything.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, and as an adolescent, I had, you know, it was a real hard time when I was going through some real difficulty. Losing my father at age 10 was no fun. And we were a family that didn't know how to process, and five males, and my mother being rather English, not knowing how to express any of her feelings, or I'm not sure if it's because she was English or just because she was who she was, but there was a cultural tendency, which, for whatever personal tendencies, she just didn't express. So there's this bombastic Italian who never had an emotion that remained unexpressed. I mean, it's unbelievable, my talk back on me. But anyway, she went off, she's now 72, and she says the most amazing thing. I mean, and I think in her case, being liberated through that pain gave her such a strength that she did not have.
Or didn't know that she had.
But you know, I certainly didn't see, of course, because who appreciates their parents other than their adolescents. She was telling me the other day she went into Safeway store to buy some meat and stood in front of the butcher counter. The guy that was behind the counter, this is a butcher, right? But the butcher guy was hacking up meat. And he sat there and he ignored her for about 10 minutes while he was hacking up meat. It's obvious he sees her. You know, and she's standing and waiting and waiting and waiting. And he just ignored her for a good long while. And finally, you know, got around to finishing up what he was doing, did something else, and then came out and says, okay. Well, I'd like some da-da-da-da, whatever she wanted, he got it for her. He was kind of cold and curt with her. She took her package and started to walk out and decided, no! Turned around, looked back at that guy and said, you were rude to me. My mother, you know. And said, I want to talk to your supervisor. Told the supervisor, just,
sometimes that's very important.
Absolutely.
Very important.
Absolutely. But this 72-year-old woman who has just, you know, turned out to be this gal with enormous amounts of chutzpah. And, you know, the older you come along, maybe. but has found herself. Sometimes our griefs, you know, I honestly feel like I said this tonight or the other night, the greatest gift that my family ever gave me was my father's death. Because it created such a need in me to find a real father, a father who doesn't leave. And I found that father in God. And have created such a hunger. I mean, it's still there, and it still throbs at times. It still comes as a pain at times. But it's probably the one thing that keeps me centered on anything else could.
Yeah, because I find that, and of course, I don't have any children, but I find another thing that so many people think they need to act gay and not put on sorrow for their children that they don't want, you know, I'm talking about grown children, you know, and I tell them, I don't think that's such a wise thing to do, you know, they need to know you're going through grief, that you're hurting.
Well, they do know. I mean, even the young children, they know it. They know it, and if you're not honest about what you're feeling, then they see what they see, they hear what they hear, and they go, okay. Reality is two different things.
Yeah, that's well, sometimes when they don't live at home, they don't see that, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people put blinders and see what they want to see.
Now, what do you do with people who don't talk?
Oftentimes, you sit with them.
Just more volume, please.
Oh, you sit with them. They don't want to talk. And oftentimes people that at that point don't want to talk still want to have somebody close. Especially, I like a fair amount of working in the alleys. Because the alleys are protected. out on the streets, you know, you can talk and that. But if you walk back in the alleys, that's privacy. And say if two homeless people, husband and wife, are fighting, you can't do a thing for them out on the streets. They may not feel they want to come in, you know, just where they're at. But if you walk through the alley and you say hi, and maybe they don't say anything, even if you just sit down, it's okay. If they want you to leave, they'll tell you. Get lost. I mean, we talk straight down there. You may sit there for a while, and it'll start coming. Yeah. And I don't know a lot about mental illness and that, but I guess you don't have to know a lot about some things to be friends. And sometimes the mentally ill, they have to live on the streets and go through all this just to sit and be there with them for a while.
Isn't it harder for the men to talk than it is for the women, or not?
I'm not sure, because I think that's generally true, but I'm not sure that that's true for people that end up on the streets. And so many of the women have such big hurts.
Yeah.
And maybe for me, because I'm a man, I still remain a symbol of that. Mm. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I do think I don't know. I guess there's so many different situations.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. Talking about storytelling, this was when I was still at Emmanuel, then I'll close with this. A woman that came down and she wanted to talk, and my office was on third floor, because there in the midst of all of the busyness of downtown Seattle, I moved from street level to third floor, and when I moved to third floor, within a month I had twice as many people coming.
I would have thought it would have been the other way around.
I know, but I didn't think so, and they had a heck of a time talking my trustees and that into letting me take that old Stube office up there. But there are hurting people, so we're right on the edge of down work. They don't want others to look in the window and see that somebody's talking to the padre.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was situated in such a way they could come up and knock on the door, didn't even have to go through the secretary. Well, she came, and for an hour, she talked, and I couldn't understand really any of it, and I was helpless, and I couldn't even enough to respond. And after the hour was over, I guess she felt, you know, I've taken enough time, and she thanked me and left. And I sat there and said, "What kind of a friend am I? I didn't say a thing." I didn't say, you know, isn't that too bad? And not a thing. The next day, she walks all the way from downtown, which is about 2 miles, just as clear as can be. "I just had to come back and thank you for what you did for me yesterday." And she was as far off the wall as anyone I've run into. I think it's one to remember. Yeah. You don't always have to have the answers. I mean, in fact, sometimes if you have the answers, you make somebody else feel stupid, because if I've been wrestling with this for 3 years and you come up in 25 seconds and give me the answer, boy, do I feel stupid.